Okay, thanks for letting me do this. And as Mike said already, this is not a formal talk. I just prepared it the last 2 days or so after having been asked last week. So what I will try to do is I will give you a rough overview of things which can happen if you admit this order to a quantum phase transition. And throughout the talk, I will essentially use Hertz version of the quantum interferomagnet as a specific example. Also, much of what I will be saying will be more general. Again, as you can see here, we'll start out by quickly reminding you of two things. First, what do I mean by weak disorder, and how does the Harris criterion come into play? These are very old things people have been thought about for 30 years. And then I will also remind you about what happens if you apply the standard law of investigating disordered phase transitions in terms of the perturbative RG, what happens in the case of an itinerant interferomagnet. And you will see that the results are very strange and in the end not really conclusive. And then in the main part, I would want to focus your attention on effects of rare regions, which will be rare regions which are devoid of any impurities. So we will consider what are the effects of these rare regions on a system in the vicinity of a quantum phase transition. We will find strong effects which depend on the spin symmetry. We'll find strong power law, quantum Griffith effects for continuous symmetry, and even stronger effect, namely a complete destruction of the transition for isosymmetry. Okay. So just for later reference, let me write down my example. So I want to look at an action Q. Action like this, and of course you all know this is Hertzsprung's quantum interferomagnet, I want to put an exponent on top of the frequency term, which I want to call Q over Z, which has the advantage that later on I can distinguish between the itinerant case, where we have Z equal 2, right, and the undamped case, where we have Z equal 1, and I can compare the two. Okay, and so far this is a clean theory, right? No, nothing disordered about it. And what I want to do now is I want to add weak disorder. What do I mean by weak disorder? I guess that's the same thing which John Neidisch called good disorder. So that's disorder which has the only effect of slightly changing the tendency toward magnetism from place to place in your sample, right? So I suppose experimentally you would want to do that with an isoelectronic substitution or something like this. You don't want to change the thermal surface topology. Nothing fancy happens, no competing interactions. The only thing you do is you change the tendency, locally change the tendency toward magnetism. And that's really the most innocent type of disorder you can think of. And this is what I will be talking about. And you will see that even in this innocent case, strange things can happen. And the way we do it in theory is we make makes this gap here or not, he makes this a random function of precision, right? So, I introduce a delta r x, which is a random function of precision.
But wouldn't you also have some imaginary component of the self-energy from the impurities as well?
That's so far at the bare level, right? I've not talked at all about renormalizations. And again, you see there's no electrons here.
Okay.
The electrons that have been integrated out in the entire procedure, right? And the idea is that in this good type of disorder, nothing interesting happens to the electrons, right?
So I it's a very naive question. Yeah. What you're saying is in the disorder, I would naively have thought in the presence of disorder there would be a damping term for the boson propagator even at zero frequency.
I don't think so.
Okay, so I'm going wrong here.
Okay, so the question is what do we take for this delta R of X? And of course historically people have liked to use Gaussians for this because they are easy to handle. And in fact, that's of course perfectly fine as long as nothing bad happens in these artificial tails that you add to the disorder, right? But we will see later on that there is cases where the tails become important, and then one should be very careful by using a Gaussian. So let me just write down two possible models for the disorder. One would be the Gaussian. So we could make delta R of X a zero average and delta correlated Gaussian.
To Mike's question,
yeah.
For the Fermi,
you
change the form of the boson propagator.
Of course, yes, sure.
Not for the Fermi.
Yeah, that's true, yes.
I understand.
For the Fermi, then you would have 1 over Q, which would turn into 1 over Q squared.
Right.
Yes. And again, as you will see later on, this is not of deep importance for the things I'm going to say. Okay, so this is the Gaussian version. But later on, I will also use what the mathematicians call Poisson disorder, and which more accurately describes a dilution type of impurities, right? So you substitute something which is strongly magnetic with something which is less magnetic, which effectively should lead to extra positive contributions to this mass here, to this gap, at random positions, right? So I will write my impurity potential delta R of X as a sum over impurity positions V of X minus XI, where the impurity positions are the XIs, and this V is some short-range positive non-negative impurity potential, right? Which locally shifts the system further away from the magnetic position. And V is supposed to be non-negative, right? Okay, so that's the model I want to look at. And yeah, now let me come to talk about the first thing which one typically does when investigating the influence of disorder on the state transition, right? And this is, as I suppose most of you know, looking at the Harris criterion. which will tell you about the potential stability of the clean critical point corresponding to the theory. We actually have this in 74. So the idea is the following. We divide the systems in blocks of the size of the correlation length, because the idea is that the system behaves coherently over this length scale. And because of the disorder now, it's clear that the overall tendency towards magnetism will vary locally from block to block, right? So we can introduce something like a critical R which depends on the block, right? And there will be variations between the between these RCs from block to block, and if we ask what is the typical variation from block to block, then it's clear that it has to go down with the size of the block, right? Because the bigger the block, the better you average over the disorder, so this has to go down, and central limit theorem immediately tells you how it has to go down. It has to go down like square root of the volume of the block, so it's c to the minus d over 2. Okay. So that's one thing we know. And the other thing is we can very easily formulate a condition for a homogeneous transition. It's clear that the system can only order as a whole if the variations in these RCs between the blocks are small compared to the global distance from the critical point. Because if I violate this criterion, then some of these blocks will be on the ordered side already, and some others will be on the disordered side, and your system falls apart. So we have to compare this, the global distance from the critical point, R, which goes like psi to the minus 1 over mu, right? That's just the definition of the critical point. Homogeneous phase transition, where the system orders collectively, it would require that R has to be bigger than this variation, right? Now, of course, you can easily work out what that means for the exponents, right? And from this, you find the well-known Harris criterion. The d times nu has to be bigger than 2. Because d over 2 here has to be larger than 1 over nu in order to fulfill the solution, right? So that's very obvious. And if this is fulfilled, then then the clean critical behavior is internally stable against adding weak disorder of this type. So one has to be careful in understanding what that means, right? You can turn it around and say, if this criterion is violated, then it's clear that the critical behavior cannot be of the given type, right? Because then the blocks will become more and more different under renormalization, under increasing length scale, and the system will fall apart. So if the Harris criterion is violated, it's clear something new must happen. However, if it's fulfilled, then it only implies a rather weak statement. It only implies an internal consistency check for the clean theory, but it does not tell you that the behavior must stay at the clean theory behavior. In particular, if you look at this derivation, you see that the Harris criterion only uses average properties of your disorder, something like an average disorder strength, which enters here. And if new physics happens at some finite length scale in the tail of your distribution, then it's obvious that it's not covered here, right? So therefore, the fact that the Harris criterion is fulfilled does not guarantee you that the clean critical behavior will be there. But it's a necessary condition, not a sufficient one. You see that actually this will happen in this case here. That's why I'm putting emphasis on this. Okay, now let's apply this to our system, our example system here. So let's apply the Harris criterion to the Hertz magnet. And so what do we know? Of course, we know that in the clean version, we have mean clean critical behavior for all dimensions larger than 2. So mu is hat. And if you plug this in here, we see that this criterion is violated for all dimensions below 4. It's clear that this order will do something to your system in order to change the properties of the critical points. They cannot be the same under this order because we are in this case. This Harris criterion is violated.
So the point is that mu is determined by the effective dimensionality, which is d plus z, but the Harris criterion is not d plus z, it's just...
Yes, maybe that's a good point that I should emphasize, right? So the D which shows up here, here, right, is always just the spatial dimensionality. No matter whether you look at the classical or the quantum phase transition, it's not D plus C. It's always just D. And the reason is, of course, if you see it comes from here, right?
Impurities are elastic.
Yeah, so the impurities are static and they don't change in time, and therefore the fluctuations here are only determined by the volume in real space, and time doesn't play a role, right? So this D here is always just the spatial dimensionality.
So can you get some rough estimate of the energy scale below which you're sure something will happen?
Well, of course, that depends on where are we on the strength of this, let's say this V, right? And then you can write down the normalization group equations and look at the flow of V. We'll write down a little bit of these lines later on, and once V becomes of order 1, then this gives you the scale that something happens, right? So that it's no absolute scale, it depends on how strong V is, right?
Sure, there is no simple formula from this temperature scale function of V.
I guess it's not hard to work out, at least for the Gaussian theory, but I'm not prepared to do it right now. Okay, so that was point one. Now I want to briefly remind you what happens if you now treat the problem the way people usually treat phase transitions plus disorder problems. And you will see that in this case it leads to rather strange results. Let me see if we can save my action. Thank you. okay, it's now point two, technically goes here. And this goes back to Oyanovsky and Kali, who did it for a classical system with extended impurities, which is very, whose order parameter series is very similar, and to Felix and Kilpatrick, who applied this scheme, Oyanovsky and Kali's scheme, to this very problem at hand. And this was in the mid-90s, I think, 96 or so. So what you do is, again, that's common law, you replicate your theory, and then you integrate out the disorder in the first step of the calculation. Okay, so and what you get, of course, the clean part of the action remains completely unchanged, right? So S is now the clean part. So this is our clean part here. The clean part plus there is a term which arises from integrating out the disorder. And if you work with the Gaussian version of the theory, Gaussian disorder. Dx, d tor prime, x, and tor prime. And you see here in the structure, the fact that there are two time integrals showing up again reflects the fact that this order is static, right? Okay, and of course I should add replica indices. So all the clean part, of course, comes with just one replica index, like here. This comes with alpha and beta. Okay, and now, once you have the theory in this form, then you can do your standard techniques, so you can try to do perturbative RG, right? So if you want to do perturbative RG, you first see there's a Gaussian fixed point, right? There's a Gaussian fixed point which has nu equal half, and our z here, and of course identical to the clean critical point discussed over here. And then you have to analyze the scale dimensions of the fluctuation terms. So we have two now. We have the quantum fluctuation term, and we have the disorder fluctuation term. And if I calculate the scale dimension of U, then I find 2 minus D, or more general, it's 4 minus Z minus D. So 2 minus D if we put Z equal 2 here, right? And you see in the physical dimensions, this is negative, reflecting the fact the quantum fluctuations don't play a role, we get the Gaussian fixed point for the clean theory. Right? However, the scale dimension of the disorder term is very different because we have two time integrals here, and it comes out to be 4 minus z. And of course, this is just a rewriting of the statement that Hermite is violated for all dimensions below 4.
And this is for any z. Well, this is just for some, are you putting some
particular value of Z? I don't think so. I think it comes out. I think the structure here makes it the Z's cancel out completely. Okay. I'm not 100% sure about that. It's clearly true for Z equal 2. Okay, so what it tells you now is you have an unstable Gaussian fixed point, and what you should do is you should now do loop expansion. And I'm not showing any details of that stuff. It's essentially the standard analysis. With one extra complication, and this extra complication is that these two terms here become relevant in different dimensions, right? And therefore you cannot do a single epsilon expansion, but you have to introduce two epsilons. One is a usual epsilon, 4 minus d, and the other one is essentially the number of time dimensions that you have. And if you make that very small, epsilon, then this also moves to 4 minus d. And then both terms become relevant in four dimensions, and then you can do a standard epsilon extension. But that's a technical complication, not a principal one.
Well, why do you have to do that? Because U-term is irrelevant.
Right.
So if the U-term is irrelevant, so why do you have to deal with
Because the physics is such that you need the quantum fluctuation to stabilize the theory. Other way, you just your disorder term just runs away.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in principle, it could still work. I think.
But in practice, it turns out it doesn't.
In my view, by putting in this second epsilon expansion, otherwise you float to infinity.
Yes. Okay, so if you do the double epsilon expansion, so what do we have? We have epsilon is 4 minus d, and then we have an epsilon 4, which is just the number of time dimensions. So if you do this, and then essentially a standard analysis is possible, and you find, indeed, you find a random fixed point. They are both U and V. Of order epsilon. So that's what you would maybe expect, right? First order. You should. You are looking for a fixed point which has now a non-zero V, because we know Harris criterion was violated. We're looking for a finite disorder fixed point, and this seems to work out well at that level. Okay.
It should be worth pointing out that if you put the physical value of epsilon at all, which is 1, there is no fixed point.
But then you have to go to two loops. I think this is repaired at two loops in parametric Pauli scheme.
What do you mean exactly with 10 dimensions? The number of toes you have, or the Z?
Well,
it's a number of
toes. Effectively, it's a number of toes. So these integrals here, right, they get modified to d tor times tor to the epsilon t minus 1. So it's really like a dimensionality full time. So I'm not changing the propagator, right? I'm changing the measure for the full time integration. Okay, so that's what you get. However, let's look at this. Let's look at the flow a little more closely.
Yeah. Can I just say something again, naive? Are you saying the disorder makes you relevant? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is that there is a fixed point where U and V, where they are both finite. In some sense, quantum fluctuation stabilizes the disorder, right?
So then deviations of U from that fixed point value become irrelevant.
Yeah. And so let's look at the flow diagram a little more closely. That's now the RD flow in the critical plane, right? So I've put R to the critical value and look at the flow in the UV plane. And of course here at zero, there's a Gaussian fixed point, right? The clean. And we also know that without this order, so along this line, the flow is towards this fixed point because U is irrelevant, right? It's like this. And we also know that on this line, the flow is outward because this order is relevant on that. It's irrelevant for the base of the Gaussian fixed point.
So that's now the critical plane?
Yes.
So the denormalized R?
Yeah, it's zero. Yes, yeah. OK, Okay, and then, as I said, there is this random fixed point which lives somewhere here, and which is stable. Okay, but now let's now look at the topology of the flow, right? So it turns out there's oscillatory connections to scaling, which is not surprising if you look at the general trend of the flow here, right? So the flow actually spirals into the fixed point, which is interesting, it's something very rare, but is itself not a problem. The problem arises if you start, look at what happens if you start out with a system which has very weak initial disorder, right? So that thing should be particularly simpler, I would think. You start somewhere here, right? Finite value for the quantum fluctuations, but very, very weak initial disorder. Then it's clear you will flow towards the Gaussian fixed point for a long time, and then you will shoot up very high here, right? So what that means is that at least systems with very small initial disorder, under RG, they will run to extremely high disorder values. Potentially, of course, outside of the region of validity of perturbation theory, at least this type of flow makes the generality of the society somewhat doubtful, right? Because we are clearly not staying, our flow does not stay in the region where things are order epsilon. Right? This flow really runs. At that level, there's no real runaway flow. If you follow the trajectories, then eventually they will come back and curl in, right? But they have huge excursions to high disorder values by doing so. And of course, that looks like a little problematic.
Just at the one loop level.
That's at the one loop level, yes. But as you see from that the topology is such that this problem does not go away, right? Because what causes this problem is that you have inward flow here and outward flow here, right?
So the fact you have these oscillatory flows, that means you have complex exponents?
Yes, yeah. Complex exponents? Yes, complex eigenvalues, yes, yeah. Okay, and indeed, a couple of years later, I think it was in 99, it was found by a student at Oregon and myself, David and Patrick, that if you try to include rare regions in a very crude way, by effectively expanding in some sense about inhomogeneous saddle points, and then this fixed point becomes unstable. However, in this perturbative approach, we could not work out what the fate of the transition is. So therefore, at least at the status quo for the perturbative approach is that we don't know what happens, right? What we find instead is runaway flow towards large disorder. Okay, so I'll leave it at that for the perturbative approach. We will see later on that by looking at the region effects, we can actually get a grip on what this is probably meaning, that we find runaway flow here, right? So therefore, I want to point your attention now to the region effects. And from now on, I will essentially use the picture of Poisson disorder instead of Gaussian disorder, because it turns out, at least for me, that discussing these direction effects in terms of impurities sitting at different defined positions is simpler. So we have now impurities of a certain concentration, which is just number of impurities per volume. And we are asking, can there be large regions of linear size L and volume L to the D, which are completely devoid of impurities? Now, elementary combinatorics tells you the probability for finding such a region. And for exponential accuracy, that's just e to the minus c times L to the d. So it's clear large regions are very, very, very rare, right? And the question is, can these rare regions, or under what conditions can these rare regions actually make a significant contribution to the physics, right? And even without writing down any equations, it's clear that if this is supposed to happen, then you will probably want a situation where the contribution of a single rare region actually grows sufficiently rapidly with the size, right, to fight the exponential here. This will be the decisive criteria later on.
How do you describe this behavior? What's the looking for?
Well, a specific question you could ask is
measurements.
What is the contribution these regions make to the susceptibility which you will measure? What is the specific heat? Right? This is what we'll be thinking that I'll be talking about in a little while. Right? Again, they are very rare, right? And normally you would expect they cannot make a significant contribution, right? Because exponentially suppressed. But you will see there's cases where the contribution of a single one is so big that actually the region contribution dominates the measured susceptibility.
So if you anneal the sample, you would lose the effect.
Anneal meaning what?
Well, put it in oven for
if you get rid of the impurities, if you get completely rid of the impurities.
Well, you modify the rare region.
So you would change the effect, probably. But as long as you have impurities, you will still find these regions, right?
If definition of impurity is that they are randomly distributed in space,
yes,
then this must always be true.
Yes, of course. I mean, if you have a stoichiometric sample, and then it would be different. But if impurities are random, then this will always hold, right?
And it must be quenched, of course.
Yeah, yes, and I've been talking about friends.
If you equilibrate with the environment, then it's not.
Of course, but we have to assume this from the very beginning. Okay, so now let's look more specifically at the case of continuous symmetry. And here the nice thing is that we can make a lot of progress using a large N approximation to understand what's going on. We will now use an n component spin and take n to infinity, right? And it's about order, I want to do things. Okay, and also what I want to do is following this general idea, right? We have to find out what is the contribution of a single impurity, single variation. And now I want to just look at a single variation, right? And look how the contribution, for instance, the sustainability of a single variation, how it depends on its size, right?
This is also probably use exponential increase in the sense that if I look on this exponent, then C become goes to zero, it looks like as if this variation becomes plotted, but it probably have an exponential factor, which also tell you that the role of impurities becomes smaller.
Yes, of course there are three exponentials. And I suppose if you want to take the limit z to zero consistently, you may need the three exponentials. But we work at some finite non-zero z, and clearly then the dominating contribution here comes from the exponential. And of course there's a power law in front here, which actually comes from...
much in comparison
to something. Not necessarily large, but clearly non-zero, right? That's, I don't know. Some finite concentration, right? 10%. Okay, so what does the log n approximation buy us? We can decouple the u times phi to the 4 term into 2 actually, I should write n times u times phi squared. It's the usual way how this magnetic classical type large n approximations work. And now it's clear that this term just renormalizes the gap, right? I want to call the renormalized R epsilon which is now R plus U times phi squared. I won't keep track of prefactors like 2 or something like this, right? So this is the renormalized gap and this N can be absorbed in the definition of U. You get a renormalization of the gap due to this term. And on the other hand, you can, of course, calculate phi squared very easily because you now have Gaussian theory. And so you get that T over L to the D sum over Q and omega 1 over epsilon plus Q squared plus omega. Our general case to the power of 2 will be.
Thomas, I'm confused about the limit here. So if you absorb n into u, then do you let n go to infinity and u go to zero so the product is finite?
The way it works, if I would write down all the factors, is that in your starting action, the u becomes the u over n.
One over n.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then things work out, right? Okay, so you see that these two equations are a self-consistent set of equations which one can solve, and the behavior of the solution will determine what happens to your relation, right? And let's discuss three cases. First, I want to consider the case of finite temperature, or you can say the classical transition, right? So, if you look at this sum here, then it's clear that at finite temperature, and of course we also have a finite L because we're looking at a single finite size region, this sum is completely discrete, and there is a potential divergence for the gap going to zero here, right? Which means you have to treat the q equal zero, omega equal zero term separately.
Why do we still have periodic boundary condition?
Because I assume that for a big enough island, the boundary condition don't do anything, right? We slightly modify the behavior, but remember, we are looking at big regions, right? So they are potentially very, very big. I'm not looking at regions which only consist of two or three or four unit cells. I'm looking at regions which potentially consist of 1,000 unit cells or something like this. And their boundary conditions should not be the leading effect. Okay, so here we have to treat the q equals zero, omega equals zero term separately. Jesus, phi squared is this term. Let me see how I want to write it. That's 1 over L to the D epsilon, or T over L to the D epsilon, plus some constant term which comes from integrating over all the other modes, right? And I've called it here 1 over GC for reasons which are not important for now. It's a constant, right? Okay, and now you see, so there's a divergence here. And of course, what that means is, if you feed it back here, you see that the gap can actually never vanish, right? And of course, we know that because we know that a classical finite size region cannot actually undergo a phase transition. The gap must remain finite. And specifically, if you now plug it back and solve it for the limit of small gaps, then you find find that epsilon is proportional to L to the minus B. So actually, we see the gap does go down, which means that the susceptibility of this island increases the size, but it only increases as a power law, right? Because 1 over epsilon is essentially the inverse. It's 1 over epsilon is essentially the susceptibility of the island, right? So it increases L, but only as a power law. And this power law cannot win against the exponential here. And therefore, in the classical case of finite temperatures, the contribution of the island will be small. We make some contribution, but it will be a small contribution because it's dominated by this exponential. Now let's look at the second case. And I want to look at the quantum case, zero temperature, but I want to keep my dynamic exponent smaller than 2. In particular, the case of the completely undamped case is equal to 1 with this class. If you do this, then it's clear that now your omega sum has become an integral. You have to integrate over omega. But of course, the q sum is still discrete. So after integrating, you have to again separate out the q equals 0 term. If you do this, following the same thing, you find that instead of a simple 1 over epsilon, you now pick up a power, right? Which comes from the integration over the dynamics. So it's one over dc plus 1 over L to the P times epsilon V minus 2 over 2. I guess I should do T, right? No, that's not a T, of course, sorry. Okay, so you see, it's still a power law divergence, right? And if you now saw it here for small epsilon, so you take this, plug it in here, and solve for small epsilon, then of course you still get a power law, right? So epsilon is now L to the, doesn't remember the exponent, 2d over z minus 2, so the inverse susceptibility still goes to zero in this case here, z is smaller than 2, but it's a different exponent, right? So in this case, but we don't get exactly the classical Griffith singularity spec, we get something that is very, very similar, because we still have a power law which loses compared to the exponential, right? So there will be no strong effects, only weak exponential Griffith singularities in this particular case here. And again, specifically the undamped case if you want is among those here. And now the third case is the most interesting one. We now again sit at zero temperature, but now we look at z equal 2, which is the case, our starting point, right? It's Hertzsprung's case. Now, when you can only guess what will happen, if you put in z equal 2 here, you get 0, and of course it points to a log, and indeed, the explicit calculation shows that now we get only a logarithmic divergence. It's a marginal case. Let me see if I get it right. I think it looks like this. Actually do the calculation. Let's see the other way around. L to the d must be outside, of course. And there's an L squared here. Yes, epsilon, of course. Yeah, sure, it's epsilon times L squared, yes. It's just the limiting version of this, right? Okay, and now you can again solve for small epsilon, putting it back, and then you find that epsilon is proportional 1 over L squared and exponential minus d times L to the d. Okay, so that's not an interesting case, right? Because now that tells us, in this case here, the gap vanishes only vanishes exponentially, right? Or in other words, the inverse the susceptibility increases exponentially with L, right? So now we have a case where the Griffith effects have a fighting chance to dominate physics, because we now play an exponentially increasing contribution to the susceptibility against these exponentially decreasing probability of finding the region, right?
What goes into B?
Essentially a combination of U and R and this constant here, which comes from integrating over the non-critical part of this integral. We have an explicit expression for that. It's called not just one line, it's a little lengthy. Okay, so now what does it mean? Okay, so what follows is essentially, now you can apply the arguments for quantum Griffith effects, which, as far as I know, date back to David Hughes and Peter Young, and who applied it to the Einstein Dyson case, and it worked exactly the same way.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So this is at n equal to infinity, right? Large n.
That's large n, yes. Exactly.
So this applies because there are two large limits. One is larger, and another is the size, the largest size of the rare region.
Well,
so if n is smaller than, for any finite n which is smaller than, then order of limit. That's.
No, I don't think that's a problem. So that's only one approximation, but I showed you here. That's a large n approximation. Look, then I look at the large n, it's not an approximation, right? Because they produce a dominating physics. And in fact, if you look at this and understand that it's the exponential increase in the susceptibility for a single island which makes the effect, then it's immediately clear that this is not an artifact of the 1 over n approximation, that's a large n approximation. But of course, it's just showing that this will happen whenever a singular region is at its lower critical dimension, at its marginal dimension. Because always, if you are at the marginal dimension, you get an exponential decrease of the gap, as opposed to a power law, right? And I use this large n to show you how it technically works out, but I should have just made a simple-minded argument that you, it's clear if the singular region is at its lower critical dimension, then you expect an exponential decrease of the gap. And that's all you need for this scheme to work out. Of course, then I wouldn't have an explicit expression. But it's clear that...
From this derivation, my understanding is you take large n limit first, and then take this rare region. So it seems to me there's n is very large first. Then you use this mean field theory to solve this gap set consistently.
Sure, sure.
Now if I reduce n, it seems to me this formula, at least from this derivation, it seems to me only works when n is much, much larger than the size of the rare region.
First of all, I don't see at all why you want to compare n with the size of the region. One is a real space measure, the other one is counting the spin components. And again, as I just argued, this result only tells you that you are at the marginal dimension of the problem. And while I use large n to get an explicit expression, it's clear that this exponential form has nothing to do with large n. It just comes out for any system which is at its marginal dimension.
So you have a general argument.
Yes, sure. And this is what I presented in the talk in the conference. And I saw that this time I should show more details than just giving the general argument. Another question?
But okay. You do consider that this is epsilon f inside the droplet. And you want to consider, I mean, essentially, your large n is, does it correspond to orbital in a way?
No, it's all of the number of spin components, right? It's the number of spin components. So it's not one of these fancy quantum large n type of approaches, but it's large n at the same level as people have done in the classical magnets, right? Because this is a bosonic theory, so I can just use a simple-minded large n. Yeah.
In the formula under 3, is it exponential minus epsilon squared or log?
That's an exponential. No, so, it should be log. Of course it should be log, because it comes out of z equals 0. Let me just check.
It's okay.
Yes,
actually. I will give you the exponential in the final answer.
No, yes, it is a log. It's also a log in my notes. I just.
Then the sign had better be different.
Yes. It is, yes.
No, of course. No, it's under the log.
And also, this has to be also. So let me see what I have here. So what I have is. Yeah, what I have is this now. This is in my notes. So I claim this is.
At any rate, the stuff in the box.
Yeah.
That makes sense and is correct, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
As long as the final answer is correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's just see what follows for observables from this, right? And as I said, these are arguments that have been made in a different context before. So now we have our exponentially small probability of finding a rare region, but we have an exponentially large contribution, or we can say we have a gap, which, well, again, suppresses the exponential factor, and thus like this, right? And it's clear that from this you get a power law density of states, right? If you just plug one into the other. So the density of states is epsilon to the power of z over b minus 1. And writing it in the more customary form, I'm going to write it as b over z prime minus 1, which essentially defines a dynamic exponent z prime. And that's the way this has been done historically. Crucial point is it's a power law form, right? Not an exponential.
This is a critical coupling, right? So
no, that's not a critical coupling. That's away from criticality, right? So that's in the region where the bulk system is still disordered, and only a few of these regions actually. Want to show local order.
This rare region is not critical. Yep.
No,
they are ordered. They are the side of the
grid. They are regions, they want to show local order, right? But of course, because they are finite, their gap never actually vanishes, right? But the bare gap is negative, right? The bare gap puts them on the ordered side, these rare regions.
If you made the island infinitely large, then it would have long range order.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the density of states. And now it's clear, if you have a power law density of low energy states, right, then you can get all types of power laws and observables, right? So for instance, you could look at the local system stability. Time local of 4, so in imaginary time, and for a single island, if you are sitting on one particular island, of course, it's just exponential of minus epsilon times 4. So on a particular island, the gap determines how quickly you decay. And now, if you want the average local susceptibility, then the average is this density, right? So the average local susceptibility, and it's clearly now with a power law, right? Because of the power law density of states, you get tau to the minus b over z prime. So the local susceptibility only falls out like a power law.
So do you know the relative size of c and the b?
Okay, that's a good point. So this exponent z prime here, or you can say c and b, they are non-universal. So they are changing if you move along the r-axis, right? If you move towards or away from the true transition. So this is a non-universal exponent.
But what guarantees that c over b is larger than 1?
It's not necessarily larger than 1.
Okay.
Can be smaller than 3. You actually can get a diverging density of states.
Can I say at the critical point b equal to 0? B vanish at the critical point? Let b vanish at the critical point. B, that small b, this is the curve. So it becomes a power law behavior, that small b, that coefficient b.
Let me see.
This b depends on the distance.
I don't think so. The problem is if you approach the true critical point, then these arguments break down, right? Because they assume that you have independent islands. So all these arguments which I made assume that the islands are there still. Of course, if you approach the true dirty critical point, then somehow they will merge and the physics becomes more complicated. I will comment on that later on, very briefly. But all these arguments assume that you can treat the island as being independent. So you're never really, using these arguments, you never really get to the dirty critical point. Then the argument breaks down.
Isn't it related with this question of the scene dividing on D, because you cannot get selectivity out of the droplet, which is bigger than the size of the droplet? I mean, your selectivity is something 1 over epsilon, right?
Yes, so, it's 1 over, yes, it's 1 over epsilon, so yes.
It's essentially a volume of your droplet, and as soon as the volume of the droplet becomes bigger than the size of the region,
I don't think so. For one spin, the susceptibility is one over t, which diverges as t goes to zero, which is the limit being considered.
This is t.
Thomas, I have another question. Is there lots of entropy associated with these regions? And if you say it's a rare region, so this effect on thermodynamics,
I will
compete with above?
Yes, sure. I will write down. The temperature dependence of stability and specific heat in a second.
Okay.
So now it's clear if you have this and you can just simply integrate to get temperature dependent locus stability, right? So. So this, like I said, of course mean average over all the islands, right? So you just integrate over this from 0 to 1 over beta, and 1 over t, sorry, and then you get that proportional t to the d over z prime minus 1. So you see the local susceptibility behaves like a power law, and in fact, it turns out that this z prime increases if you go towards the true transition, and at some point, then you actually get a divergence, right? Because if z prime becomes larger than d, then the local susceptibility actually diverges, even though you are still in the disorder phase. You get a very strong effect, and this is one of these power law quantum Gödel's effects, which now, a few people claim to have seen an experiment, and they are much, much, much stronger than the classical Gödel's effects, where you only get exponentially small corrections to the conventional behavior.
So, again, z prime increased when you reach the transition?
Z prime goes up if you go through the dirty transition. And there's a few models out there. It has been shown that it actually diverges at that point. I'm not sure if there's a general proof, but for several models, it has been shown that the C prime diverges at the dirty transition.
What about the prefactor? Is it peak or?
So that's the same thing as B vanishes. B vanishes at the critical point.
B must go to infinity, right?
No, if Z prime goes to infinity,
then
B goes infinity.
Yeah, or Z goes to zero, right?
C is a constant, is a concentration. So B goes to infinity.
Yes, and I guess it's probably true. B must go to infinity. Provided these arguments can be carried all the way through. And as I said, actually, that's dangerous, right? Because if you approach the true transition, then items will merge and things, more complicated things will happen. Yeah, of course, the prefactor is of course non-universal and depends on the strength of the disorder, right? If z is very small, then also the prefactor must come out small, right? I don't have an explicit expression for the prefactor. Okay, and in the same way, you can work out specific heat contribution of regions, and you find again a very similar power law. So there's also a power law contribution to the specific heat in this region. Okay, then that's.
Heat is now minus one. If you have a constant density of states, you get a linear specific heat. So it's d over z prime is one.
Well, what we found is that the energy goes like t to the d over z plus 1, and specifically goes t to the... So you're saying the one is wrong, right? Yes, it's wrong. I just checked in the paper. The energy goes like d over z plus 1, and this side goes like d over z. Okay, so let's recapitulate. In this continuous symmetry case, which I showed you using the large n approximation, we found that the gap for a single island never vanishes, right? So the island is always fluctuating because there's a finite gap. But for the z equal 2 case, the itinerant case, the fluctuations are so slow that a single island makes an exponentially large contribution to the susceptibility, and therefore we get these power law quantum Griffith effects. And again, I want to emphasize that this is what you find for the continuous symmetry case, not for the Ising case where it was first argued, right? And now, because I'm running overtime, way over time, let me just very briefly comment on what happened in the Ising case, right? Just to contrast the two. So the fact that we got these very strong power law quantum Griffith effects relied on the fact that our region was at the marginal dimension, right? And we got this exponential decrease of the gap, the size. Now, of course, you can ask what happened in the Ising case. So let's again look at the singular region and ask what is the behavior of a singular region with Ising symmetry. But now it turns out you're not at the marginal case anymore, but instead you can get a true phase transition for a singular region, because the region effectively corresponds to an Ising model, one-dimensional, there's a long-range interaction, because the 1 over omega translates into a 1 over tau squared. So now I'm just not doing calculation, just giving the general argument, right?
It's like an Ising model in one dimension, but with sufficiently long-range interaction, yeah. You have a finite transition.
Whereas in the case before, we had a 1D Heisenberg model, or a continuous symmetry model, this one of the tau-squared interaction. But it has been known since the 70s that the 1D Heisenberg model is at the marginal dimension, just repeating what I derived explicitly. It's also known since the 70s that the 1D Ising model is a one of the tau-squared interaction, actually does have a phase transition. So what that means is that in this case, the gap actually does become zero, and the island ceases to tunnel, at least a sufficiently big island. Right? So the phase transition, of course, means the vanishing of the gap, right? So the islands cease to tunnel, they don't tunnel anymore, and of course, in the quantum language, you would say the damping just prevents them from tunneling, right? The lambda damping, the mod omega is lambda damping, so they don't tunnel anymore, and therefore, So they become static, and this, of course, leads to a Smear phase transition, because then static order will develop independently on several regions as soon as it goes to static. And this is what I talked about in more detail during the conference. So I think I leave it at that for now. And before I stop, I want to very briefly point out that all of what I've said implies a very simple-minded classification of these weak disorder effects in terms of the effective dimensionality of the region. There are three cases, right? If the effective dimensionality of the rare region is below the marginal dimension, below DC minus, the lower critical dimension, then the rare region, of course, cannot order, and its gap behaves like a power law of its size.
By the effective, you mean D plus Z?
Yes, yeah.
What do you mean by the effective again?
This statement means that a singular region is at the marginal dimension, right? And of course, you have to include the time dimension of the quantum phase transition. If you talk about the classical transition, it would just be B, right? The classification applies to both. It's a lower critical dimension. It's a dimension at which you start to get a phase transition, right?
This for the
eigenplates, no? I'm trying to make a general classification of what can happen, right? There's three cases.
My hand was in D plus 2, there was a problem which is the orthophilical dimension for the system. For the anti-four magnet, when we went back, the log went for D equal 2. No? C equal 0. No?
I'm not quite sure. What is the question?
We went for the case for the continuous anti-four magnet.
Yeah.
And for Z equal 2,
then,
the dimension.
Then we are right. Then we are in the second case. And we are right at the marginal dimension, right?
But your previous argument didn't depend on dimensionality, right?
I'm talking about the effective dimensionality of a single rare region. Of course, the region is always zero dimension in the space direction, right? But it has an extension in the time direction.
So it's Z.
So it's Z.
If Z is equal to 2, then we have a probability.
Yeah, yes.
It's
Z, yes. Yeah, because the singular region is zero dimension in space, of course, right? And then there's a third case where the effective dimensionality is bigger. And so in this first case, and this is where all the classical Dirichlet effects fall into, right? Because Z is just zero, and the effective dimensionality is zero, right? Then you get very weak Dirichlet effects, right? Because you play the exponential against the power law, and nothing interesting happens. So you get classical Dirichlet effects. And some quantum systems also fall into this case. You remember the Heisenberg version is equal to 1 also led to exponentially weak effects. Here, if you are right at the marginal dimension, then things work out nicely because the two exponentials balance, the exponential rarity of the rare regions and the exponentially strong effect of a single rare region, and you get power law effects, right? So that's power law quantum Dirichlet effects. And down here in the third case, which is the one which I just very briefly mentioned in the end, you are a single rare region is above the lower critical dimension, so it can have a true phase transition. And then you get a Smear transition here. Okay. So maybe I should stop here.
Why
thank you.
Rising correspond to Z marginal 2?
Because in some sense this is a symbolic notation. It just means that a singular region can develop static order, right?
It's not complete. because in this, when you're at marginal diverge.
It depends on how you read this, the effective, right? It contains all the positive cases, but if you are sitting at the marginal dimension, then you can either fall into, you can also fall into this one if you get a constant side-to-side position, as it's the case in the Eisen, case. But these are the three phenomenological cases which can appear.
Would you expect in a real physical system that one of these rare regions going would drive the other regions critical as well?
Yeah, in some sense polarize them, right, slightly. And so what it leads to, the prediction, is this exponential tail that we were discussing, I don't know, some time ago, right? If you have the phase diagram, and your clean system, this would be your clean system, right, the clean phase boundary, right, that makes it, I don't know, not disorder because I want to have extra tuning for a little pressure. And now you disorder it, right? So the phase boundary would look like this. And now it would not go down to a new quantum physical point here, but develop an exponential tail all the way to this point. And this is the effect of the smear transition, right? Because here a few variations order and then slightly polarize the rest, right? This makes this exponential tail here.
So again, it would be nice if we could have some other magnitude on which you can see this scale, because the function of disorder of because you know maybe the question is it observable or not, and in which condition it is.
Yeah, that's true. That of course it involves a lot of phase factors, and we have not yet worked that out. But it's obvious that it has to be done. I know the function form down here, right? But I so far, I don't know any of the three factors.
Can you tell me what is P? I'm sorry. P
parameter. Some tuning parameter.
Some tuning.
But in not disorder, because I want to compare the clean and the disorder case, right?
But I mean, in typical systems like superconductors or whatever, I think this also happens in the chromium case. I think typically disorder effect is the other way, right? I mean, so it sort of follows a clean line and then has a disorder until actually going to higher pressures.
Yeah, but that's fine, right? Because you can all the arguments turn them around depending on whether you dope with something which prefers or deters the magnetism, right? If you have dope with something which actually prefers magnetism, right? Then you all the same arguments apply, but things just turn around, right? That's nothing qualitatively changes. Yes.
In the case of the in the Eisen case.
Yeah.
So, do you still have in mind the field theory that you had in the beginning for the Hertz theory?
Yes, of course.
The Q squared plus one omega.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if that is so, when you have rare regions that have finite extent, shouldn't you put in the field theory omega plus so mod omega plus one over L squared, where L is the size of the rare region? And therefore, you will have a screening of the 1 over tau minus tau prime squared interaction that may lead to no longer in order at zero temperature?
No. Okay, that's two answers. First answer is, of course, if anything, it should come out of the theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the starting theory is the starting theory, right? And if I start from the field theory, of course, there's no cutoff for the dynamic term. If something like this happens, it should come out of the theory. But now, of course, what I should point out is that these long range interaction is in time direction, right? So I don't think it's cut off by by the finite size of the region. Provided, of course, that's a good point. Provided that the electron system, the underlying electron system, is still extended. But that's implied in all what I've said, because if the electron system would not be extended, then you would really, then your region would just be a finite system, right? With a finite number of degrees of freedom. And we know this cannot have a phase transition in general, right? There's a rigorous proof that a finite system cannot have a phase transition. So all that I've been saying about this singular region becoming static implies that the underlying electron system is still extended and provides damping, a gapless damping, right? Otherwise, of course, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, then the field theory at first is not doesn't seem to describe the situation.
Oh, it does. But we have to be careful when switching from describing from the full field theory to describing a single variation, right?
Okay.
Of course, the starting field theory is still fine, but I have to be careful when going to describing a single variation that I keep my L consistent gapless as describing an extended L consistent, not also restrict the L consistent to the sizes of the region, because then you would develop a gap. That's cool. Damping would break down.
But in two dimensions, electron states are all localized. Of course, there's a localization ring that's very large.
Yeah.
And so you have to assume that your system is smaller than a localized.
Yes. Two dimensions is tricky in various respects. And to be on the safe side, of course, I would first look at 3D, right? Yeah, what happens to these electrons in 2D is even the starting point is, and I saw it from Hertzsprung's picture, and while we know it is at least intrinsically consistent in 3D, we know it from Andrei Chubukov's calculations, it's not so in 2D, right?
More questions? So, it didn't become a discussion session after all. This is my theory, you know, is that if you tell a graduate student a half an hour, it's a half an hour. You tell a postdoc in half an hour, it's probably 45 minutes, but the last 15 minutes he looks nervous. But if it's one of us, it's going to be an hour and a half always. Anyway, it was a very, very nice summary, Thomas.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.